go ahead, sir.
Thank you for joining us today. As you are probably aware, the initial eligibility trends working group has met for the past 2 days here in Newport Beach, California, to examine trends in secondary education. And joining us today for this call to give you an update of what transpired over the past 2 days is Kevin Lennon. Kevin is the Vice President for Membership Services with the NCAA, and he is chair of the working group. I'd like to now turn the call over to Kevin for some opening remarks, and then we will go ahead and take questions today. Kevin?
Thank you, Eric, and good afternoon to you all. As Eric pointed out, we just culminated 2 days of meetings involving the Blue Ribbon panel that was assembled at the request of Miles Brand to deal with issues related to initial eligibility trends with a particular focus on issues related to the quality of high school education in some instances across the country. I'm pleased to provide an update for you today. As a reminder, the panel that I referred to is comprised of college and university presidents and other higher education administrators, faculty members, athletic directors, conference officials, and high school officials as well. It really is a diverse group, and I think that reflects the complexities and the challenges of some of the issues that we're going to talk about today. It was clear through the course of our discussion that the vast majority of our high schools and preparatory schools do a good job in preparing our young people for not only higher education, but the ability to contribute to society. And the vast majority obviously have a great deal of integrity. Our focus in coming together today was to deal with certain institutions in secondary education where perhaps that integrity is lacking. And that was the primary focus of the majority of our discussion today, how the NCAA can go about addressing this issue. I would also emphasize that the group focused on the fact that this really isn't a concern as much about how coursework is delivered, the method, if you will, recognizing that technology and other enhancements have provided our students with great opportunities to learn in a very diverse ways that perhaps were not available in the past. But the focus is largely on the integrity of those courses and the integrity of the coursework. And again, that was the primary focus of the Blue Ribbon panel in the discussions the past 2 days. Underscoring all of this, and I think this is extremely important to note, is that this is an issue that we all need to be concerned about. Everyone who cares about the quality of secondary education, everyone who cares about our young people being prepared to contribute to society and to for those who want to pursue higher education, to do so with a level of preparedness that will allow them to be successful. This is not just an athletics issue. It's clear from the data that the vast majority of individuals who attend some of the schools that have come under our scrutiny are in fact not student athletes. They are going on to take on different jobs, different roles in society, and the broader concern that we have is, are they ready to meet those challenges? So I continue to stress again, and the panel certainly did, that this is not an athletics issue, but it is one where we can play an important role, and I'd like to outline for you some of the thoughts of the group that are going to be pursued over the course of the next several months. The goal is to identify specific recommendations that we can put forward to President Brand and ultimately our Board of Directors and President's Council by June 1st. So it is an ambitious timeline, but it's one, certainly at the end of the 2 days of discussion, that we feel we can meet, and that the recommendations that will ultimately come forward will help address some of the concerns that have been raised related to academic fraud that have been posed by some prep schools and other diploma mills. The recommendations can be broken down in a couple of larger headings. The first is to really begin a process of identifying those high schools or prep schools that fall outside any type of state oversight or jurisdiction related to the quality and monitoring of their curriculum. As I mentioned in my opening comments, many and most of the non-traditional high schools do have integrity and do provide a quality education. But it is clear that some do not. And the NCAA is committed to providing for a process that will increase the evaluation criteria of those schools to make sure that they, in fact, are credible and are delivering a quality education. So there will be a great focus on the source, on the high school, if you will, in better assuring that they, in fact, are doing what they are charged to do, and that's providing a quality education. A subcommittee has been formed that will work hard over the next couple of months to identify the criteria that will be used, the questions that will be asked of these high schools, the evaluation criteria for how schools will either be continue to be on the acceptable list or criteria that would require them to be removed from the list, and the fact that they're not providing a quality education. Issues related to potential audits and perhaps even on-site visits are something the group will consider, again, with the aim of making sure that we're able to sort out those high schools that are doing their job and doing it well, as opposed to those that are really diploma mills and not providing a quality education. The second area relates to the specific students and their core course taking behavior, if you will, and a great deal of focus there in particular on course patterns, particularly in their senior year or in a prep school year, if you will, and identification perhaps of a minimum number of hours, a maximum number of hours that would be allowed to be used during the senior year or a prep school year for purposes of meeting initial eligibility requirements. The group was presented with academic profiles of some students that I think were of great concern to the panel, quite candidly. Individuals who had showed little preparation for the college experience in grades 9 through 11 and in grades 12 or in prep school had really made some miraculous recoveries that I think are going to come under greater scrutiny, if you will. So the second area, which really deals with core course-taking patterns, again, particularly in senior year of prep school, will be another subcommittee's charge, and they will be looking at over the next couple of months to perhaps come up with specific legislative proposals to address those particular issues. The third area related to test-taking patterns involving the SAT and the ACT, policy changes some years back provided greater liberalization, if you will, of how test scores are being reported to the clearinghouse and to our campuses. The committee is concerned about some of the integrity of the reporting in that regard is going to be examining certain policy changes that potentially would require more official reporting of test scores to the testing agencies. That group will also be considering which students should be required to provide these official test scores, and again, that's something that the staff and the committee will be looking at over the course of the next couple of months. The final issue that I would note here before we turn it over to the Q&A is the committee recognizes that these are real problems, and we believe that we have the resources and certainly the commitment of the association to address these issues in a very timely manner. We know that the abuses are going on as we speak, and I think there is a great sense of urgency among all of the members of the committee to take on these issues as quickly as possible. They were very comfortable that we ought to be making statements, and I appreciate all of your help in getting this word out, that any student who is contemplating leaving their high school right now, here in February, simply to pick up additional courses for eligibility purposes, they need to be aware that the NCAA will be implementing policies in the very near future to address these abuses. Students need to make sure they are taking real courses, academic courses, and are not simply trying to buy eligibility. And so for your readers and those who would be attentive to this issue here over the next couple of weeks, we want them to know that changes are on the way. I think the panel and certainly our membership are committed to addressing these abuses to make sure that our students are in fact receiving a quality education and are prepared to come to our campuses to meet the increased academic requirements that have been established. So with that, Eric, I think we'll take questions.
Thank you, Kevin. Operator, can you explain how persons on the line can ask questions today?
Yes, Mr. Christensen. The question and answer session will be conducted electronically. If you'd like to ask a question, please do so by pressing the star key, followed by the digit 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. We will proceed in the order you signal us, and we'll take as many questions as time permits. Once again, please press star 1 on your touch-tone telephone, and we'll pause a moment to assemble our queue. And we'll take our first question from Mark Schlabach of Washington Post.
Hi, Mark. Go ahead. Mark, are you there?
Sir, can you hear me?
Yes, we're here.
Okay, sorry. As far as what's being done right now before these new policies and measures are put in place, in terms of a private school, a private preparatory school postgraduate that doesn't fall under the state statutes that would allow a state board of education to monitor their curriculum and classes, what can the NCAA do to monitor what kids, what grades and scores kids are receiving at those schools right now?
Well, this is Kevin. In terms of the evaluation of the high school, the current practice is to pose a series of questions to any high school that wants the clearinghouse to use those courses for purposes of students meeting eligibility. They have to respond to a series of questions that relate to the academic rigor and the type of instruction they provide to the students. We have, in some instances, had fraudulent information that came back from high schools in response to questions, and the NCAA has already taken some action to remove those particular schools from our acceptable list. It's our thought that we're going to move pretty quickly with the recommendations that I outlined, that we will begin providing greater scrutiny and questions in a way where we can address some of the problems that have occurred. So I would think that by this summer we'll be in a position to have criteria outlined that I think will do a better job of fleshing out those institutions that are not of significant rigor, and obviously at that point in time those schools would no longer be on the approved list.
At this point, are there any on-site visits done at all? I mean, it's just surprising that a school that's basically a storefront without teachers, without classrooms, could get on the clearinghouse list.
Well, the group talked about the potential of providing on-site visits based on responses that we're going to get back from high schools. At this point in time, that is not a role that the NCAA has played. We have had some instances where our enforcement staff has made a visit to a campus or two, but it is not a systematic visitation program, if you will. We've relied more on the integrity of the information from the high school principal, but I think it has become clear over, you know, our review of this particular issue that additional scrutiny is going to be necessary, and we're going to begin with that by basically asking more questions of those high schools that we have identified where we need more information. And it's possible at the end of the day that those visits could become just a routine part of the evaluation process.
Next question, please.
We'll go next to Jack Carey of USA Today.
Jack, go ahead.
Kevin, can you specifically outline some of these questions you're going to be asking these people, and what specifically were you looking at in the meetings, and are these a written list of questions or procedures they're going to have to answer to? What exactly are you looking for?
Yeah, I think the concept here is to identify those institutions that are really outside of any kind of state oversight. You know, we recognize that public schools, by their very nature, have a level of accreditation or certification or oversight by other agencies, and we're going to rely upon those agencies to continue to do what they've done, and that's monitor the quality of the program. We did talk a little bit about instances in which the clearinghouse or the NCAA may actually flag certain issues for the state agencies when we believe there's some potential abuses. But again, in their structure, they have an oversight body. So once we separate those who already are within a structure with those that don't have any regulatory oversight, that particular group is the one that we're going to focus on. And the list of questions that will be asked of them are really expanding some of the basic things that we have already asked them, but getting much more detail, increased documentation to, again, ensure an appropriate level of academic rigor. You know, the group did look at some specific questions. That's one of the things that the subcommittee is going to look at. How do you go about identifying, you know, these type of schools? And some of it's as basic as just those high schools that simply charge a flat fee to get a diploma. You You know, there are things that are outside the norm of any secondary education structure that we believe we can identify at a first-cut criteria and pull those institutions out for greater scrutiny. I would imagine that by our April meeting, we will have the very specific set of criteria with which we will be asking schools, as well as how we're going to evaluate those responses to end up pulling schools off the list.
How do you, I imagine the crux of this is to essentially let students know that they shouldn't go to these schools if they want to be passed by the clearinghouse. How do you get this word out to people in the short term, at least, if you're looking at, you know, this sense of urgency you're talking about?
Yeah, I do think at the end of the day that sunshine is going to help in this regard, and I think there's a commitment from the panel that once an institution has been removed from the list, is no longer acceptable based on their responses and based on our review, that we will be very public about that so that the students will know that attending that particular high school is not going to help you from an academic eligibility perspective. But also, as I mentioned at the very end of my comments, you know, I think it's important that students themselves evaluate the quality of the courses. And they know, in fact, if they're not taking courses of any academic rigor. And what we're suggesting to them is that practice is no longer going to be acceptable. We're a couple of months away from putting the specifics to that. But my encouragement to anyone, whether it be a coach or a third party or the student themselves that is planning on making a move out of their high school right now, solely for eligibility purposes, I think they need to look long and hard at the academic rigor and know that at the end of the day, we may simply say, no, we're not accepting those courses.
Even for next fall, you mean?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Next question, please.
We'll go next to Duff Wilson of the New York Times.
Duff, go ahead.
Hi. Kevin, what information has been given to the Miami-Dade State Attorney on University High School by the NCAA?
I'm going to ask Diane Dickman, our Managing Director of Membership Services, to respond to that, Duff.
Thanks.
Sure, this is Diane. That state attorney that's handling the case actually called our office a couple of weeks ago and was looking for some basic background information. So we provided some basic background information, similar information that we had provided to the working group. It wasn't specific to any particular high school. It wasn't specific to University High School, which I believe he's looking into. It was just general information, helping educate him about the NCAA processes and those types of things.
Okay. And has University High School been removed from the NCAA clearinghouse list?
This is Diane again. Yes, they have. As a result of your good investigative reporting at the New York Times, some issues came to light to us that were inconsistent with our NCAA academic legislation, and so we sent a letter to University High School seeking clarification on some responses that they had provided to us previously through the process, and through that gave them a window of opportunity to clarify their answers, and as a result of those interactions, they are no longer courses from University High School no longer can be used for NCAA initial eligibility purposes.
Do you think that University High School answered questions falsely on their questionnaire?
I think that what became clear through that process is that their courses do not meet our NCAA legislation.
And how many high schools have been so removed from the clearinghouse since December?
Three.
Which other ones, Diane, can you say?
I don't have that list with me.
Were they the other ones that were so-called accredited by the National Association of Legal Support for Alternative Schools?
I'm not sure what the other two's accreditation status was.
Okay. But were they other Florida schools, do you know?
I do not believe that they were Florida.
Okay, and let me just ask one more question about Florida, I guess, in specific, because you said that you'd like to, as one of the priorities, identify schools with no regulatory oversight and focus on them. the Florida state law specifically says there's no regulatory oversight on its private schools. So do I take that to mean that you would identify all the private schools in Florida?
Well, this is Kevin, and Diane can certainly jump in. You know, I think the way to think about this stuff is it really is a sorting process.
Mm-hmm.
And at the first level of sort, I think that is a group that you identify, those that are high schools that fall outside of any kind of regulatory or oversight body. After you've identified and had that first sort, there's a series of other questions that will be posed to really, again, begin separating out those secondary schools where they have integrity and those that are really just a diploma mill. And I think the group envisions that being a series of levels of questions of sorting that gets you down to the ones that you're most concerned with. Because, again, keep in mind, we're not trying to indict all non-traditional schools. We know that the vast majority have integrity and do a good job. Our job is to try to separate out those that don't. And that would apply for all states, not just in the state of Florida.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Next question, please.
We'll go next to Brad Wolverton of the Chronicle of Higher Education.
Hi, Brad. Go ahead.
Hi, Eric. Question was, did the panel look at, or do you have any idea of how many prep schools we're talking about that are outside of state oversight?
You know, we weren't able to come up with that specific number. We've gone back and asked and charged our clearinghouse with identifying and telling us kind of what the volume will be. I did hear just recently that, you know, and one of the things I think surprised the committee is that every week, you know, you're seeing new non-traditional high schools entering the clearinghouse and applying for application to have their courses approved. That this is a dynamic process, one that is increasing, like I said, on a weekly basis. So it's a little tough right now to see exactly what the size of the population is, but I would imagine that by April we'll have a pretty good idea.
I mean, do you have the sense that you're talking like dozens, hundreds, something like that, or any idea at all?
I think you're way more than hundreds. That's my sense.
And did I hear you right that you expect to have some new rules in place by the next school year?
Yeah, the group spent some time talking about how ambitious they could be in terms of implementation. Some things would be policy changes that are easier to implement. Others would require legislative action. This group had three university presidents on the panel, and I think there's a general agreement that we need to move sooner rather than later. If that requires the presidential bodies to adopting changes in this April or this August, I think the group was very willing to recommend that so that you know, we could put some of these measures in place before the next academic year begins.
What about, obviously, the last question, sorry, beyond June, since this is sort of an issue that goes beyond athletics, you say, do you have bigger goals for what you might do?
Yeah, that's something that the group just began talking a little bit about, what type of partnership opportunities are available with other communities who, as I mentioned, need to be interested in this issue beyond athletics. I would imagine that we'll have more thoughts on that coming out of April. Whether this group remains past June, I think, is an issue for Miles to discuss. It's very possible that kind of ownership of some of these issues from an NSAE perspective could be put into other bodies in our governance structure. We'll just have to wait to see how that plays out, Brad.
Thanks.
Thanks. Next question, please.
And we'll take our next question from David Epstein of Inside Higher Ed.
Hi,
David,
Kevin.
Go ahead.
I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the questions or the nature of questions that you saw fraudulent responses on. I mean, are these questions about course material or institutional accreditation, or what kind of questions were getting those?
This is Diane. One question that we've seen to be problematic has to do with a line of questioning regarding the teaching of students and whether teaching is actually occurring, whether there are actually teachers at the high school, and what and sort of how that interaction between the student and the teacher or the high school, how that transpires. Our requirements require, as part of NSAE legislation, that there be instructional components and interaction between teachers and students. And in some cases, as we have seen over the last few months, that that is not occurring.
Gotcha. Also, for students who are taking courses in these institutions, say, right now, if their high school is removed from the clearinghouse this summer, would that affect them for this coming fall?
This is Kevin. Yes, it would. As we have looked at this, you know, the fact that we have some students who are not taking courses of academic rigor, they are not legitimate courses. I think the NSA staff, legal counsel, and I think certainly the task force here believes that in no way should those students be rewarded. They're not prepared for the college experience. The courses that they took are not going to be used for eligibility purposes, and they would have to find other means of completing either their high school degree or becoming eligible, perhaps attending a junior college or whatever they would choose. But there was a sense that if you find out that the courses are of no rigor, there's no reason to grandfather those students in. You take action immediately.
Gotcha. And last question is, since there were problems, I guess there's a requirement to be some teacher-student interaction. Are there going to kind of also be rules reworked for what kind of correspondence courses are going to be allowable? I mean, are some correspondence courses still going to be allowable?
As Kevin talked about at the beginning, there are many non-traditional programs that are very legitimate and give students a very high-quality education, and the intent is certainly not to disrupt that flow of education. I think the issue that we see is when, as we've seen in some of the newspaper articles, the buy a diploma, if you will, in the diploma mill world where there really is no teaching occurring, there's no instruction, that doesn't meet our current legislation. So I don't think the group sees that we need to change that legislation. We simply need to ensure that students really are having a quality educational experience, regardless of the delivery method. We don't specify that it has to be in a classroom in a traditional setting, and we recognize there's much good that can come via courses over the Internet, but we need to ensure that learning and teaching is really occurring.
Thank you.
Next question, please.
Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, it's star one at this time, and we'll take a follow-up question from Mark Schlabe of Washington Post.
Hey, Mark, go ahead.
Two questions. You said that the kids that are enrolled now in these schools wouldn't be grandfathered in. What about in regards to students who are already enrolled at NCAA institutions? Would they face eligibility issues? Would the school face any possibility of sanctions? And B, second question, Lutheran Christian Academy in Philadelphia, have been removed from the list.
This is Kevin. Let me I'll address both the questions. The policy at this point in time is that once a student has enrolled, we're not going to go back and make a change in that initial eligibility decision. And that's kind of the clear line of demarcation. Once they're in school, they're now subject to other progress towards degree requirements at those institutions, and that's the standards that they would need to meet to remain eligible. So there won't be any going back and changing their status. I am not aware, as Diane mentioned, at this point in time, we've had three schools that have been removed. I'm not aware of the other two institutions, Mark. But obviously, as the group works, and once we have the list, as I mentioned before, we'll be able to provide some sunshine and let folks know who those institutions are.
Thank you. Next question, please.
We'll go next to Emily Badger of the Orlando Sentinel.
Have some of the students that we were just talking about who are already enrolled in schools and who have past attended some of these diploma mills, have they been involved in any sense in the NCAA's review of this issue and discussing with them now that they're at college whether or not they've been sufficiently prepared and having gone through this experience?
Emily, this is Kevin. The answer is direct communication back with the students. No, I'm not aware that we have had any. Some have been reported, and Duff, his article obviously outlined some responses in terms of the preparedness, but the NSA has not gone out and asked in a qualitative way how these young people felt about picking up 8, 9, 10 classes in a 3, 4 week period of time. We are, as we always are with our academic issues, interested in gathering data in terms of academic performance of these students. And we are going to continue to look at how well these students who attended these type of high schools do in college. Unfortunately, we don't have a lot of data beyond freshman year for the groups that we're talking about. Over time, I think that data will be instructive. If students are not prepared adequately to come into college, it's likely that as they move further along their degree, they're going to have more problems. But we're going to gather that data, study it, and again, I think it's a piece of the puzzle, the evaluation, but I think there's other issues here that I think are also help kind of driving why we need to do it.
Thank you. Next question, please.
And as a final reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, that's star one at this time. And we'll take our next question from Matt Rennie of the Washington Post.
Kevin, you mentioned in your initial comments the committee looking over some individual data that we saw what you'd call miraculous recoveries in a senior year or a postgraduate year among certain individuals. If that raised eyebrows on the committee, how do you feel, was there anything incumbent upon your member institutions to have raised the same eyebrows before admitting these students?
You know, that is a very good point, and a couple of things that I would note in that regard. You know, the certification by our clearinghouse should be one of just many factors considered by an institution when they decide to admit student-athletes. It is an important factor. I will give you that. But it is also, I think, even more important that the admissions process on the campus make its own evaluation of that student's readiness for the academic rigor on that campus. Campuses vary in terms of their rigor. They have different missions. So to say that an individual is simply certified by the clearinghouse and therefore is likely to be successful on your campus is an inaccurate statement and I think sets some students up for failure. So, you know, we're going to examine it from a clearinghouse perspective. How can we go about tightening this up and doing the best we can to make sure that when the clearinghouse makes a final certification, it is one that reflects the integrity of the process. But that is not in any way to usurp the responsibility of a campus in making its own examination. And I think we're going to see an increased emphasis on that as a result of the work of this panel, to remind institutions of their responsibilities to look at the veracity of the academic profile of these students before they admit them.
And finally, when you talk about the additional scrutiny, increased level of scrutiny on the part of the clearinghouse, was it the committee's sense that this was going to require a substantial increase in resources to be able to try to verify the information that you're getting from these schools?
You know, I think that's one of the things that's going to happen at the subcommittee level over the next 2 months is as we put the specifics down to what this additional scrutiny will look like, what criteria would be applied in the evaluation of responses, I think one of the charges of that group will be, you know, how does this impact resources at the clearinghouse level, at the national office level, and I guess perhaps even at the campus level. But we're going to be attentive to it, but I really don't have any response to that right now.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. Next question, please.
We'll take a follow-up question from Duff Wilson of the New York Times.
Thanks. I'd like to understand one of the numbers you said in answer to another question. Well over 100 schools identified so far that are what? Lacking adequate oversight already that may receive further oversight from the NCAA?
No, Duff, this is Kevin. Let me clarify. The response that was to a question of how many did we think, I think it was from Brad, how many do we think are fall in this non-traditional category? And the question was, you know, 5, 20, or 100. And I said, I think it's well over 100. I just don't know the exact number. But again, that we're talking about that as a first sorting. That's not saying that those are the ones at the end of the day where you say, this is really a diploma mill, this doesn't have integrity. I don't know what that number is, but that's something that we're going to try to get our hands around, obviously.
Let me understand. There could be three numbers. How many are in the possible non-traditional category, a smaller number, how many you really want to ask more questions of, and a small number, how many you disqualify? What's his hundreds? Is that the first number, the whole universe that you'd look at, or those that may need to be asked additional questions to certify their integrity?
Yeah, I think I do understand your question. I'm not sure that at the end of the day we're going to divide it up into those three levels of sorting. You know, as I mentioned, every week the clearinghouse is getting new non-traditional high schools submitting information. As it stands right now, it's probably close to around 5,000 or a little bit more that fall at that first sort of non-traditional high schools
right. In
our database. Okay,
right.
But again, that number continues to increase, as I mentioned, every week. The next level of sorting is still yet to be determined. But at the end of the day, you want a process that says, based on these responses and based on other auditing, visits, whatever it is, we have now determined that this final number of schools needs to be removed.
Mm-hmm.
They are not a sufficient rigor. Now, how many cuts and sorts along the way, I don't know yet. I think that's what the subcommittee is going to evaluate. All I know is that it will not be the 5,000-plus that we talked about that
right.
are non-traditional, because the vast majority of those do a good job. It will be a far fewer number, and that's what we're working towards.
And so with the reference to more than 100, meaning those that there would be additional auditing and possibly visits and questions to?
No, the 100, again, was just in response to Brad's question when he asked, do you think it's more than 100? And I said, yes, it's more than 100. It's actually, like I said, as it stands right now, probably around 5,000 plus.
Okay. Thanks.
Sure.
Next question, please.
And we'll take a follow-up question and our last question from Jack Carey of USA Today.
Diane, it's just some housekeeping here. Can you spell your last name for us, please?
Dickman, D-I-C-K-M-A-N.
Thank you.
Jack, this is Eric for you and others. Diane's title is Managing Director of Membership Services for the NCAA.
And it appears there are no further questions at this time. Mr. Christensen, I'd like to turn the conference back over to you for any additional or closing remarks.
Thank you again for joining us today. Want to point out that if you have not already received our press release that summarizes the meeting today, you can find that on the NCAA website at ncaa.org. Thank you for joining us today.